people are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Since 1931, the National Housing Conference has been helping to ensure safe, decent, and affordable housing for everyone in the United States. It's a tall order, particularly now in the 21st century, and it's a challenge that has been accepted by the organization's new president and CEO, Chris Estes, our guest today. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing. In today's program, we will talk about Chris's new role, the current state of housing issues and the challenges we all face, and how we can work toward a more effective housing policy and ideally improved federal funding. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, by way of introduction, Chris comes to NHC after 9 years as executive director of the North Carolina Housing Coalition, one of the nation's best-known state housing groups, which provides advocacy and resource information on affordable housing for low- and moderate-income residents of the state. Under his leadership, the coalition worked to pass important consumer protections in manufactured housing, as well as legislation that created key foreclosure prevention programs. So, Chris, I can only assume that shifting from a state perspective to a national one is going to bring a whole host of new challenges for you. Can you describe some of the shift in focus that you're experiencing?
Sure. In some ways, it's not as big of a change as you might normally think, because housing's one of those things that there's a lot of issues about how it gets done on the ground that at the state and local level, but ultimately still a lot of the funding comes from the federal level. And so even folks who are state level advocates are always kind of focused on federal housing policy. The biggest change for me will probably be that I will be much more engaged and sort of dive into the finance level kind of issues that are happening in Washington. And some of that is really more about the sort of juncture we are in history than anything else, that we're facing sequestration and a potential dramatic cut to all non-discretionary funding, which could have a huge impact on housing. We're looking at the reform and redesign of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and what that might mean, and potential tax reform and what that could mean for the low-income housing tax credit. So those issues are in some ways more current and more national. And so everybody in the country is paying attention to those. But there are things that I will probably be spending a lot more time on than I would if I was still at the state level.
Sure. You know, it's interesting you say everyone at the state level is tuned in to what's going on the federal level. But does the reverse hold true? Do people on the federal level really tune in to the kinds of issues that folks on the state and local level are grappling with on a daily basis?
I don't think so. I think that's actually one of the perspectives that I hope to bring to Washington, is a much better understanding of sort of what happens on the ground and what the intersection between state and local housing policy and federal housing policy. I think it's easy when you are at the federal level, the issues are big and the discussions can be somewhat insular with the folks that are in D.C. that are in those same discussions all the time. And you are sort of one step removed from practitioners, especially of sort of how housing gets done on the ground. And it's a good perspective to have that I think always served me well in North Carolina working at the state level, was to really be connected to what was going on in local communities around our state. And my goal for me at NHC is that I know what's happening in other states as well as I knew what was happening in North Carolina, so that I'm always bringing that perspective to federal work, but also trying to bring issues that benefit folks at the state and local level to them, work that either we're doing or the Center of Housing Policy is doing, and in the process really having a good channel of communications about federal housing policy with folks.
Chris, tell us a little bit more about your background. What were you doing before you were running the state organization?
Sure. So I came to housing in a I won't say roundabout way, but it was sort of an evolutionary progress where I was had sort of settled into a career doing nonprofit fundraising work for various groups in the Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill area of North Carolina, the YMCA, the United Way, and I got involved with a statewide effort to improve early childhood development that was done locally in each county in the state and was raising money around that. And that actually had a lot of kind of community development angles and looked at a lot of neighborhood poverty and things like that. And that actually, that work led me to pursue a master's in social work with a focus on community practice and planning. My first year at the School of Social Work, I worked at a family resource center in a low-income community and realized that folks there, everybody had housing-related issues, whether they were renters or owners, and decided to get a second master's in city and regional planning, focusing on housing and community development. And while I was in planning school, I worked for about a year and a half with a nonprofit affordable housing developer that did both single family and multifamily and housing counseling work. And also did some state budget and policy analysis work with a sort of a research advocacy group. And when I came out of school, I worked on the Corporation for Enterprise Development's asset report card, the first report card they did back in 2002 on state asset policies. And then worked for a year for a tax credit equity syndicator that was a nonprofit that did regional syndication in the Southeast.
I can see why they hired you for this job. You've really had the gamut of experience. Let's provide an overview of the work that NHC does, and then we can drill down to the different areas of focus right now.
So NHC has historically played this kind of big tent advocacy role, I think particularly representing the development community in the affordable housing spectrum and beyond in Washington. I think in the early days it was easier because housing was a little less siloed. It was mostly around HUD funding and the sort of tax incentive programs for developers to produce affordable housing. As housing got more complex in the 80s and 90s, NHC has sort of played more of an intermediary role from time to time. And I think at times people haven't always been as clear about what it was doing as it played, I think, somewhat of an inside baseball role in D.C. about linking people together who were working on housing policy. I would say under the current staff, particularly on our policy staff, we've played a significant role around in our policy working groups, bringing folks together around important policy issues and finding ways to issue comments or make statements and try to provide direction as NHC on a lot of these big housing issues that are in front of us as it related to the mortgage meltdown and foreclosure recovery and where to go with the future of Fannie and Freddie. Additionally, NHC has had an affiliate research organization, the Center for Housing Policy, which has tended to focus more on kind of why housing matters, what its impact and benefits are, what are the particular constituent groups that benefit or need housing that often have some real relevance for folks at the state and local level. And my goal is how we sort of bring that work and NHC's work together in sort of a greater level of intersection so that we're really being seen as sort of from the outside one organization with one kind of value and expertise that stretches across a continuum, both for whether policymakers are looking at us or the housing community or funders in that regard.
That makes a lot of sense. So on the policy side, NHC's been active in advocating for solutions to the foreclosure problem. Can you talk about this effort and what you think some of the important solutions are?
Sure. I think the first thing I would say is that what we've been particularly focused on recently is as much around foreclosure recovery as the foreclosure crisis itself, because obviously the most important piece to sort of stave off future foreclosures is how do we stabilize neighborhoods that are vulnerable? How do we get people reinvesting in housing to slow property value declines? And how do we help support the homeowners that are still owning homes by ensuring that new buyers are not frozen out of the market? So there's several angles of that work. We've been looking a lot and advocating around how the learnings from the neighborhood stabilization program could be continued with the project rebuild work, and urging that support, looking at how the hardest hit funds can continue to be used to stave off foreclosures from people who are particularly facing job loss, and how that might bring stability. We're making recommendations and looking at principal write-downs, particularly the work of the Ocwen group that's done some of that as a urging that to be looked at as a national demonstration project. We've been looking at how the two of the biggest lenders, Wells Fargo and Bank of America, are doing as part of their foreclosure recovery and sort of mitigation efforts. And we're particularly interested in engaging them on the kind of more recovery side, or what to do with REO property and how to engage local community development folks in that work. Finally, I would say we're also particularly interested in how the restructuring of lending and everything from the qualified mortgage and issues and other regulatory stuff that might take place around lending, as well as the future of Fannie and Freddie, to ensure that new first-time home buyers and folks at sort of moderate income levels are not frozen out of the mortgage market, which we think would have a really debilitating issue on people's ability to recover, neighborhoods' ability to recover from foreclosure.
So as you know, parts of California have been particularly hard hit by foreclosure. San Bernardino recently suggested that they'd consider using eminent domain to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. I know that NHC has investigated this option and has publicly commented on it. Can you give us your thoughts on this?
Sure. So I think eminent domain is a controversial but potentially powerful tool, and I think it's sort of best example was the redevelopment of a historically disadvantaged and kind of somewhat abused community in Boston, and how a local community development organization and community used eminent domain to kind of reclaim their property and sort of control what got built there, and to try to remove blighted property, and it's really was sort of a national model. I think, and it makes sense that the communities that were particularly hard hit by foreclosure might think, is this a strategy we should pursue in terms of how are we going to make sure that folks who are underwater are still maintaining that those properties are being maintained, and so we don't experience too much blight or abandonment. Our concerns really centered around, and our analysis was that using eminent domain in a mortgage lending setting, where people would just basically seize mortgages from loan holders because people were upside down, even though they were still paying their mortgages, could create all sorts of shockwaves in the mortgage lending environment that could have really catastrophic consequences and a lot of unintended consequences. And that we urged the FHFA to really look through what those unintended consequences were, to be really clear about whether Fannie and Freddie would participate in buying mortgages that had gone through the eminent domain process, because one of the dangers would be that cities could decide we're going to go down this path, and then no one is there to sort of participate in the secondary mortgage market. And so then you've got this sort of stagnation and greater confusion, as well as sort of first line lenders not wanting to get involved in those communities at all because they're worried about investor liability and sort of return on investment and all that stuff. So we viewed it as that there were lots of other tools to be looking at for foreclosure mitigation, foreclosure prevention, and foreclosure recovery, and that this one had a lot of potentially negative consequences, and in particular, we wanted FHA to be clear about how it was envisioning Fannie and Freddie's involvement in it, because that one needed to be a key factor for people to really understand how the process would work, and as well as cities' abilities to sort of financially pull this off. So that was sort of our analysis on that.
What are NHC's proposals for what ought to happen at this point to Fannie and Freddie?
Well, what we've been particularly focused on is two elements to Fannie and Freddie, and I think one sub-issue. So generally, the big issue is there going to be a government guarantee of some kind or not, sort of a government backstop?
In our lifetime.
Right. With whoever the new entity is, we're assuming that Fannie and Freddie, as they exist now, will no longer exist at some point. There'll obviously be a phase out, so it's not going to be like tomorrow we're going to wake up and there's not going to be an entity there. But so the government guarantee itself is the major question, and the concerns, and those stem out of this notion of accessibility and affordability. So on the single family side, with without some sort of government guarantee that produces lending, stable, affordable, and accessible lending to low and moderate income people, will essentially those folks who represent slightly higher risk categories or just less well understood risk categories be sort of frozen out of the lending market. And I should add that, you know, one of the complicating factors in lending is this, you know, you can sort of operate at the 10,000 foot level and say, well, capital flows where it makes money. And there really is no bias involved. But the reality is capital flows where people direct it. And there are clear examples throughout history of how capital has been biased against people of certain races or people in certain parts of the country or certain parts of our community. And this continued throughout the throughout leading up to the mortgage crisis. So the assumption that people who represent different risk profiles will be handled in some sort of clinical, statistical way with no bias is just not borne out to be true. And so we know that usually having some sort of requirement to go with that guarantee that allows people to have some accessible lending is really critical. And that leads to that second point of sort of, if you're going to have a guarantee, what do you get for it? What does it cost? What are the requirements to do it? Not necessarily down the path of goals for affordability, but more about just sort of how the guarantee works. And then the second piece, which is really the subcategory, is the part of lending that worked really well for Fannie and Freddie and was really vital to affordable housing was the lending that went towards multifamily, particularly affordable multifamily. And that had had gone very well. It was not part of the mortgage crash. And we are particularly concerned with that sort of side of the industry, that lending be able to continue, and that however the GSEs get remade, that some particular attention happens around multifamily lending to ensure that, again, we don't just focus on the big single family questions and end up hurting this industry that's pretty vital to the affordable housing world.
Absolutely. NHC focuses on promoting transit-oriented development and smart growth. Can you talk about why this is important for our communities and the work that you're doing in this area?
Sure. Yeah, this was actually a big issue that we worked on in North Carolina. And I think it stems out of a larger framework that in the normal kind of intervention, affordable housing intervention, people who are building affordable housing usually have to go where land is cheapest. To build, to make the numbers work, whether they're doing single family or multifamily. And generally, by definition of sort of how the market works, land is cheapest in areas that have the least amount of amenities or furthest away from stuff and sort of the least, you know, there's less desire to live there. The more desirability to a location, the higher the price point. And so that sort of basically market-based framework that affordable housing operate in lend itself to an environment where affordable housing was generally further away from everything. It was built on the outsides of towns or in parts of the city that had had a lot of disinvestment and were less desirable. Our point was that you can't just look at affordable housing by the cost of the mortgage or the cost of the rent and utilities. And utilities is sort of a second theme of energy efficiency. But what is the whole cost to live there? And if the housing was basically creating significant transportation burdens for folks And in North Carolina, we saw this where a lot of folks on the single family side would actually live sort of one county away from where they worked. And, you know, when gas was $2.70, $3 a gallon, not a big burden. When gas jumped to $4 a gallon, all of a sudden it was a huge cost to people to commute that far. And we even saw counties that had struggled with employment because people would no longer drive that far for an $8 to $10 an hour job. It was just not worth it. And so we were actually getting calls from Chamber of Commerce and other folks about how to figure out how to get housing built near stuff. So the transit is sort of the microcosm of that, and that's both with bus and rapid transit, so that you can really have housing so that people can choose cheaper and more accessible ways to get around. For some populations, like people with disabilities and seniors, it's sort of vital because they're less likely to be able to drive. And so if they're going to be able to get to the healthcare and services they need, as well as to the grocery store or whatever employment they may have, that transit accessibility is really vital to their quality of life. But more importantly, it's really about when you're looking at the success of transit-oriented development as an economic development tool, where you see a lot of development happening around these transit hubs because people want an option to get out of their cars. If you don't intentionally plan for and include affordable housing for people at the low and moderate income levels, they will be priced out of that land right away. And therefore, they're sort of not able to take advantage of the linkages and connections and cost savings that come from being able to get out of your car and use transportation.
You really can't look at any of these issues without looking at the others. That housing is inextricably bound to the supportive services, to the transportation planning, all of it.
Right. And I think it's a particular issue that's important because there's not it requires people to get out of their silos a little bit, sort of like energy efficiency, which is typically handled through the Department of Energy, not HUD. Transportation is a separate whole division in D.C., as well as usually separate divisions at the state level and even separate parts of the planning department at the local level. So what we found in North Carolina was when we were working on this issue for an expansion of light rail, even getting communities that wanted to do it, it was a challenge just to get the conversations and the right planning to happen because these things were done by completely different people whose budgets were different. And so it takes a lot of work to help people understand beyond just the why, but sort of how it gets done.
Right. And then to get the right people at the table.
Right. Exactly.
So, Chris, if you had a housing policy wish list right off the top of your head, what would be the top items?
So I will preface this by saying this is my personal wish list because I don't know that I would be able to give an official NHC wish list. And I'm also going to say this is what I think are the three, and I'm actually going to say four things that are the most important right now. This is not necessarily stuff that I think we'll be working on in the next few months or whatever. But one piece is obviously there's a huge need for more funding in the development of housing. And I think my first wish would be that we would find a way to get $1 billion a year in dedicated funding to the National Housing Trust Fund that would then flow out to states for their efforts to produce more affordable housing. And as part of that, there really needs to be an expansion of project-based vouchers, which sort of allows people to get rent reductions in a variety of new or rehabbed housing developments, mainly because there's just such a huge unmet need in housing for folks, particularly those at 30% and below of AMI. It was the unknown housing crisis before the mortgage meltdown, and it certainly is part of the housing crisis now. The second piece is, I mentioned Project Rebuild. I really think there's a huge need for both this funding for reclosure, recovery, and bringing REO properties back online, coupled with an expansion of housing counseling funding. We know that housing counseling works and led to successful homeownership situations. And if we're really going to look at how some of our communities that have been really hard hit by foreclosure, taking what we learned from the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, And applying that in Project Rebuild with expanded housing counseling, I think, is a really key step to getting that going. And then finally, my third or whatever number this is, that is sort of a bigger macro goal, and that is that we end up with some government-backed intermediary that helps produce affordable and accessible lending to low and moderate income people, as well as the affordable multifamily development segment. And that's sort of my big wish for whatever happens with reform in the next 2 years. And I would add that probably my, you know, the most important wish is that Congress finds a way to avoid sequestration and the dramatic cuts of trillions of dollars to discretionary spending. And maybe that's all I needed to wish for, since that will mean the most in the next few months.
Excellent. Well, your insights have been really illuminating, Chris, and I'd love to be able to send our listeners to your website so that they can learn more about NHC, perhaps join the conference.
Sure, it'd be great. We would love to have folks join. We're particularly interested in expanding our membership across the country, and really plan to be rolling out a lot more work at the state and local level combined with the Center for Housing Policy. Our website is www.nhc.org, and you can find both us and the Center for Housing Policy there. The center is getting ready to put out a new report around housing and transportation costs in the next week or so, and so folks can find that there in addition to their other stuff and learn more about who we are and what we're trying to do, and you can join on the website.
Excellent. Chris Estes, President and CEO of the National Housing Conference. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for talking.
And I'm Joanne Green. You can download more episodes of the Affordable Housing Podcast by visiting edenhousing.org.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.